Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Good evening. Good evening for those of you in other time zones.
Let's see, good evening, or perhaps good night in China, maybe. Yeah.
Yes. Let's see. We have a busy call today. We have quite a number of presentations, two on resiliency methods continuing from last time, and then we have three on microservices, and if we get to time, Parviz is going to do a brief update on the Tiger Team activities. Let's see, I see a bunch of people joining, so we'll give everybody about 1 minute for the joins to settle down, and then we'll get started.
Hi, Chris. Bharat here.
Hi, Bharat.
Chris, I sent you the slides, so I didn't find the best place to upload, so I didn't want to upload in a random place.
Okay, great. They go on the contributions page, but we can straighten that out after the call. So if they're in my inbox, I can post them after the call.
Perfect. Thanks.
Sure. Let's see. It looks like the joins have slowed. Why don't we get started? Why don't we start with the two presentations on the resiliency methods? Bharath, do you want to start?
Sure, I could start.
Great.
Just 1 minute. I wanted to make sure at least Roger is here. Yeah, I can. Roger and Srini are here. Okay, cool. Thanks. So just want to make sure, can you guys see my slides now?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Chris, thanks for this opportunity. Sorry, I couldn't make it last time. I had to, in an emergency, I had to leave the city. So I just wanted to present some ideas here on a common high availability platform that we have been building within AT&T that we think could be very useful for ONAP as well. I've had some discussions with Roger on this, and I see that he's also here on this call. So I have 20 minutes, Chris? Is that correct?
Yes, that works.
Thanks. Okay, so the overarching goal here is one that is pretty familiar to us, right? That we want to build ONAP components with 5 nines of availability on 3 nines or lower cloud infrastructure in a cost-effective manner. And in this slide deck, I focus on ONAP, but the same applies even to VNFs or as we move towards the edge, all our services. This seems to be the main goal. And we believe that to achieve this goal in the limit, ONAP needs to support these three facets. One is it should be multi-site. It should ideally be active-active services. We would like to see a active-active MSO, active-active SDNC. And the third point is that we also need efficient failover. So this figure kind of shows what is the target that perhaps ONAP would have. You have these three sites across the world. And when I say ONAP, it could be any ONAP component. And what I'm showing here is that each component maintains state corresponding to its own requests, but it also maintains state corresponding to the other controllers so that if one of them goes down, it can take over fast. And this is the real goal if we want to achieve 5 nines of availability, at least that's what we believe. And currently we know that some of them are active-passive, some components are active-active, and we should be able to, the resiliency platform needs to support all these models. But the main problem in achieving this goal is, we look at it as three major problems, right? One is that when you're deploying replicated components across geo-distributed sites. The classical ONAP example seems to be Beijing, Amsterdam, Irvine. And you need to start worrying about things like wide area latencies, which could be in the order of hundreds of milliseconds. We also need to worry about network partitions, like what happens if my site is completely partitioned from another site. That's the first problem. I'll give examples of what I mean by these problems. The second thing is you need to design complex distributed protocols in order to achieve this multi-site active-active settings with failure. For example, even things that we take for granted, like distributed failure detection, leader election, federation, it tends to be complex, especially when we talk about a world in which there can be partitions and they are deployed across sites. And finally, it's also the fact that ONAP itself seems to need to support pretty diverse replication or resiliency requirements, right? Like some ONAP components have replicated state while others claim that they do not. Some are very strict about how inputs need to be processed by the replicas, others don't care. So you can't just have a one-size-fits-all solution. You need to have the ability to provide building blocks that people can build the way they want. And let me just give some specific instances of these problems. Now, for example, MSO uses Komunda internally, and Komunda uses this database called H2, which is a SQL database. Now, you take that SQL database, a transactional SQL database, and simply throw it in a cluster across multiple sites, then they may not satisfy the latency constraints, number one, because let's say you want to perform a write and that needs to be performed transactionally across all these replicas of MSO. When the WAN latencies are in the order of hundreds of milliseconds, each write could almost take half a second, right? If it has to be transactional. So that compromises on the latency requirements and hence throughput too. And availability is a completely different problem. For example, if the site in Beijing gets completely disconnected because of network partitions or link breakages from Amsterdam, now the local site may not even be able to perform any operations because the transactional cluster database will not support it. That's one example of how things get harder when we move across multiple sites with state replication.
And just to be sure, you were talking about ONAP here and the challenges we have with the management platform itself, not the workloads, right?
No, just the management platform itself. Yeah, okay. I'm assuming that the workflows above will support these paradigms of active-active or active-passive. I mean, it is something for us to worry about, but right now I'm just focusing on the platform. The second point I was making was regarding complex distributed protocols. And we had discussions with the tech dev folks here in AppSea, and they were talking about how they want AppSea clusters within each site. And if one of the AppSea clusters goes down, somebody else should be able to take over. Now, even this very simple, seemingly simple requirement has some issues, right? Like how can you detect the failure of an AppSea cluster? How can you make sure that it has really failed and it is not just partitioned away? How can we ensure there are no split brain problems? And when an AppSea cluster fails, how do you redirect its requests? This is an example of the second problem that I raised of complex distributed protocols, right? And of course, the diverse replication requirements. SDNC, when we spoke to folks, they said SDNC state can be replicated across sites in a lazy manner, so may not need very strong replication semantics. Whereas AppSea had stronger requirements that AppSea request needs to be processed by only one cluster. Here, well, then this is a stronger requirement, whereas SDNC seems not to care so much. Now, similarly, when we looked at the MSO Komunda database tables, some seemed very critical for state management. They were process tables, task tables, whereas others were simply record keeping tables. We don't need really any strong replication semantics for them. So that's kind of what I meant by diverse replication requirements. The current practice, which I'm sure a lot of you will acknowledge is that each team is building its own solution. I mean, at least within AT&T, we have seen this a lot, that somebody is using their own database mirroring technique, somebody is using CoroSync, somebody is using IDNS. The trouble is when different people are trying to do the same thing to solve a problem, very similar problems, it's pretty wasteful. And even more worrisome is it can be erroneous because, like I said, these are complex protocols with a lot of corner cases. So the requirement and the platform that we are proposing, we call it CHAP, is that we first need to identify the common availability and resiliency problems across ONAP, right? And provide a high availability platform that will give these ONAP components shared services. And ideally, these components should simply be able to configure and use these services and CHAP according to their needs. That would be the utopian goal that CHAP is trying to provide here. And here are the building blocks of CHAP. The first thing is MUSIC. It's this multi-site distributed database. I mean, I'm calling it a distributed database, but in reality, it is just a shim layer on top of Cassandra. I'll go into more details about the complexity, but MUSIC is a geo-distributed Cassandra with a shim layer that provides stronger semantics. This has been tested and within AT&T now for around 1.5 years. We have been deploying it in production. Then the next building block of CHAP is we have this service called HAL, which provides configurable recipes for leader election, federation, resiliency, and so on. I know that there has been discussions on how we need to build keep alive failure detection services using console. HAL is similar. It's just that it uses Zookeeper rather than console. And the main philosophical goal of HAL is that if a service, you're trying to replicate a service and you want failure detection and so on, you should not have to write that code yourself. You should simply be able to do some configuration and the HAL protocol will take care of all this so that we can avoid mistakes. Finally, Conductor. We use Conductor for site selection. Now, in a replicated system, if somebody goes down, we need to take the decision who should handle the requests of the failed replica. And Conductor helps in this. It helps in performing site selection. Now, Conductor is already part of ONAP as the homing service. So we are just using certain aspects of Conductor for site selection.
Which project is Conductor part of?
It's the Ecomp homing service.
Optimization framework, Alex.
Yeah.
So it's not in yet. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry, I probably overstated that.
You got me excited, you know. I thought we had something already.
No, sorry. Let me say aggressive discussions going on, but
We are several of us are deeply involved in that, so that's Alex is so passionate. So.
Okay. Yeah. So Conductor came from our team. It's part of the same team from which, and Conductor uses MUSIC internally as its database. So, yeah.
I'm curious why not use console and surf, or a combination of those as opposed to what you're suggesting. Can you talk about the alternatives and why they were rejected?
Yes, I mean, so first and foremost, Conductor does use, Conductor used Cassandra simply because it was built from scratch. It did not need the querying power of a database, and it was envisioned to be a highly multi-site tool. And so the obvious choice was Cassandra, right? So and after that, Conductor realized that it needed more stronger properties from Cassandra. And that answers your question, why not use console? So we, in fact, when I say MUSIC, right, it's essentially Cassandra with a tool like console. I mean, like, you know, Zookeeper is just very similar to console in what it provides. And it uses Zookeeper, MUSIC/Zookeeper for locks on top of Cassandra. So it is not too much of a stretch to say that Conductor is actually using something very similar to Console on top of Cassandra. Whenever it doesn't want strong properties, it goes directly to Cassandra. When it wants stronger properties, it uses Console / Zookeeper to do its leader election kind of thing. So I can go into slightly more details, but to answer your question, it does use Console or Zookeeper. It's just that its underlying data store is Cassandra because it doesn't need to be a database. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I was, you're making an assumption that the only way to write ONAP components is in a way that would require all this.
Oh, no, not at all. I think some ONAP components might want to use the database. Some ONAP components might want to use a key value store. We are not prescribing that they have to do one or the other. In fact, we are only saying, I mean, if you could just let me move on to the next slide. Sure. I'm sorry, I can't see who's talking.
This is Alex.
Hi, Alex. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Okay, no, so, yeah. It tells me my screen sharing is paused. Okay, now it's fine. Yeah, you guys can still see my slides, right?
Yes, we can see them.
Yeah. Okay, so Alex, we aren't prescribing that ONAP should use this database or it should not use a SQL database. Conductor started with Cassandra. It needed stronger properties, and Music provided those properties on top of Cassandra using Console / Zookeeper style locks. That's it. The whole claim behind Music is that, which is the next slide. The idea behind Music is that, now let's say you have this service replicated across three sites. That could be any ONAP component, as far as we care. Each ONAP component can continue writing to its own SQL database. It could be MariaDB, it could be MySQL, it could be Postgres, you know? We do not ask anybody to change that. So for example, let's say you have a active-passive or even active-active system. And let's say the active is reading to a database. Now, even now, within a site, the active will continue reading and writing to its own local SQL database, whatever it might be, whatever that they're already comfortable with. Now, Music provides the ability, Music intercepts these calls to the database, and it provides the option to either synchronously or asynchronously replicate this data to a standby instance. Now, whenever the standby has to take over on active failure, Music will provide it with the latest state. So you can look at it as each ONAP component can do what it wants. Music is simply arbitrating state management across sites, just providing a reflection mechanism across sites so that they don't need to worry about multi-site performance. Does that come? I mean, there are more details to this, but does that make sense from a high level?
Hi. Yeah, hey, this Parviz, when you talk about ONAP components, all this state management that you're talking about, you are referring to the ODL platform for controllers, correct?
It depends, right? Even MSO has state. For example, MSO has...
No.
Yeah.
No, I'm not talking about SO or MSO. For controllers, there is no specific implementation. This is just taken from the ODL implementation for now, correct?
Correct.
Okay,
so
thank you.
For example, I don't think I'll have the time today, but we are actively working right now with SDNC in TechDev to take their ODL database and provide a multi-site service using Music. So the ODL controller continues writing to its own database, which is MariaDB, and it gets automatically reflected across sites by Music. So we are doing precisely that right now, trying to work with ODL too.
What if I'm not using ODL, or what if I want to do something entirely different?
So maybe an example of that would be you want to use Postgres database, for example, right?
I'm trying to understand if Music is a data abstraction layer, or is it more of an object abstraction layer, or how do you... There are two ways to do this, right? I can persist objects from my model, and somebody will decide for me the optimal way to do that across the network.
Yes.
Or I can have this sort of, you know, this data abstraction layer that allows me to do queries and and it commits to the database, but then underneath that there's some polyglot thing that decides where it goes and how fast it needs to be replicated.
Yeah, so the answer is both. So, and let me explain that. Now, for components that are willing to write code from scratch, right, who are not yet dependent on any database, like Conductor is a good example of that. Music more or less acts like the first option that you gave. It provides you the interface to store data. It provides you the interface to write queries. It openly gives you the abstractions that through which you can determine what kind of consistency you want. But we understand that that is not a luxury that every ONAP component might have. They might have their own requirements. And for example, they might be using a Postgres database. In this case, Music morphs into the second option that you spoke about, wherein you keep doing writing to your database. There is an underlying layer that copies it across the network optimally. So it's both based on where the ONAP component is right now. So we provide a plugin for both purposes. Yeah.
I mean, eventually we need to achieve some level of consistency in terms of how we do persistence. I don't think you will survive for very long with each component doing its own thing. Operationally, that's not sustainable.
So that is true. I mean, but here the authoritative data is still with Music, and persistence is still with Music. So CHAP, the common service that it provides, is responsible for maintaining Music, ensuring that data is maintained there. The way to look at it is that while Music is the authoritative source of data, like I said, it has Cassandra, right? So internally, all the data is stored in Cassandra. Each ONAP component is talking to its local SQL cache. That's another way to look at it.
I see.
Yeah.
There is a cache. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that describes it very well. About to ask that question. Yeah. I think that articulated yeah. beautifully.
No. The state management is not really the same issue for each component. You mentioned SO or MSO.
Yes.
My understanding is that in the initial SO implementation, of course, the ECOM implementation, there is practically no state to manage, correct, for SO. But for SPNC, APC, and other controllers, that is where that has been heavily debated in ODL, and we cannot just sit here and overnight redesign that. We have to really have a project and look into this. This is a long-term investment, yeah?
So the point is that we aren't trying to redesign that. That's kind of what I'm trying to say here, yeah. is that if ODL wants to, for example, to be very precise, ODL uses AKA and...
yes, AKA, yeah.
Right? Now,
and the GASP is for distribution, yeah?
Correct. And we are just telling them, you keep writing to MariaDB, treat your MariaDB as a local cache. We will intercept those calls. Music provides a shim layer called MDBC that will intercept those calls and do multi-site state management. In fact, we think it's very hard to go and tell people don't use this database or don't use that database. We feel,
yeah.
And databases are extremely well tested and reliable for performance within a site. So we won't interfere with that. We will just provide a mechanism to, you know, they can treat it as a local cache. We'll provide a mechanism to authoritatively persist across sites.
So do you guys decide based on what object? I mean, so there are two ways to go. Like you said, you can let the individual components kind of keep writing data, right? Or you can turn this around and say it's really just about persisting object instances in some common data model that we're all working towards, right?
Yeah.
And the question becomes, you know, who determines the cadence, the consistency model for each one of the objects? Where would that be? In terms of that policy driven?
This is Roger. If I can interrupt, it's a much more complicated problem than that. I think we quickly discarded the problems in SO. Right? That orchestrator is keeping track of all of the operations that are happening in ONAP. And if that fails, then you have the chance of repeating transactions or, you know, getting the sequence of transactions incomplete. So it's a really complicated problem. I don't think we should be so casual about having one solution fit all the problem spaces.
Well, that's not what I'm
saying. Roger.
I mean, that's...
Hold on, Alex. Roger, it's fair to say that for SO, practically there is no state to manage, correct?
No, I don't think that's true.
Yeah, but Parviz, what he's saying is that within a transaction, if you have gone through one third of the way of the transaction, you know what part has been executed, what are still being to be executed. That's the state he's talking about, not that...
One question. This music which you mentioned, the wrapper, is it meant only for SQLDB or does it work with any other database? Like if service is using, let's say, you know, MongoDB, for example, does it support that also or is it currently limited to SQLDB?
Yeah, that's a good question. So currently it supports Cassandra, H2, MySQL and MariaDB. It doesn't support MongoDB yet, but writing a shim layer to support that is pretty easy in terms of the fact that we have a modular development model, but currently it only supports the databases that I said. And I completely agree with Roger's point. I mean, just managing the state does not mean you solve the end-to-end resiliency problem. So for example, we might replicate state across sites, but MSO doesn't support that transactional model where, you know, we can just point to another site and things will work. All of this will break down. So I think so it's currently what we're doing, and it's a pretty exhausting exercise, is that we go and talk to every component. Like we have almost 3 months of discussions with APSI to discuss how state management and their larger picture comes together. And similarly for SDNC. So I have some of those designs here. We won't have the time to present them, but I agree with Roger. It's not enough to just provide a common state management solution. Yeah.
And also, Bharat, another point note, it's also important to think about A&AI database, because that's one which is frequently used across the board by all components.
Yes.
And, you know, so we'll also talk, I don't want to hog this session, we'll also talk about some consistent intent-driven APIs and what it means.
Got it.
Probably this dovetails nicely to your presentation.
Got it. I'll just give you a brief idea of my discussions with ANAI. I mean, so since ANAI is tied to that graph database that they have Titan, right? And they seem to be mired right now in whether they should use HBase as the underlying data store or Cassandra. But we are trying to understand what database they're going to use. Like,
So the other approach could be like slightly up-leveling the problem and really bring in sort of this data microservices angle and say that, hey, let's design, first the intent-driven APIs, not make it specific to database. For example, if you look at A&AI, it's a graph database. And, you know, in fact, right in the API, if you pull up the API, it's talking about graph edges. But the same graph database can be achieved, like, you know, through a NoSQL method, like you said, through HBase or, you know, other databases, right?
But you have to be careful and not try to redesign all the components, so we'll be here forever.
No. Roger, just to be clear, we are not trying to redesign. All we are trying to say is first, let's define the APIs to be consistent so that the database is replaceable, right? We are not just married to one type of database, right? Correct. That's all you're saying.
And okay. I
do have another question. You talk about, for example, using this to do a geo-redundant solution for MariaDB. Have you contrasted your work against existing solution like Galleria for clustering of MariaDB? How does your solution, how is it better than existing solutions?
Okay, so two questions. The first thing is, have you compared with existing solutions and how does it perform better than Galera? So we have compared. So initially, Music was built as a tool that is trying to do better than Zookeeper across the wide area, right? That was its original goal. And hence we compared with Zookeeper and we show how for normal operations, the performance is much better than Zookeeper, almost 1:2, because clearly, Zookeeper, when for every write performed to Zookeeper, you have to go through this distributed agreement or Paxos protocol, In music, you don't have to do that because it's actually a Cassandra write. So that's number one answer.
So Bharath, just a point about that. I thought you mentioned earlier that you actually use ZooKeeper as part of your protocols for some of the transactions. Yeah. So wouldn't the performance of ZooKeeper be a limit?
No. So the advantage with music is that it takes ZooKeeper's abilities and condenses it into a lock. So let me give you a precise example, right? Let's say you do 100 writes in ZooKeeper. Each write goes through the performance limit of ZooKeeper. In music, the way it works is you acquire a lock to the key and then you do 100 operations to Cassandra. So in essence, we have condensed the performance problem of ZooKeeper into just that lock acquisition. So it amortizes the cost much, much better. So that's the answer.
But there are all these trade-offs for that. But anyway, I'll let you go. Absolutely. Go ahead.
But you also asked another question about MariaDB performance. We are currently getting benchmarks to give you precise answers of how music compares to MariaDB and so on. I think within a month we should have that ready. But at least let me explain intuitively what's going on here, right? I mean, a MariaDB transactional write across clusters, if anything, is going to be, should be even more expensive than ZooKeeper, right? Transactionality is harder to achieve than distributed agreement. So we hope that, you know, the results that we had comparing ourselves with ZooKeeper will hold for this too, but burden is on us to kind of show that is the case. So the answer is no, I don't have the performance results comparing it with MariaDB, but I'll have it very soon.
Yeah, Bharath, I think it's great that you're doing this. It's a very tough thing. There be dragons here, so it's great that someone's looking at it, but I just want you and everyone to realize these are really, really hard problems. People have worked on these distributed databases and trying to reconcile after WAN outage things for a long, long time.
Agreed.
So just Agreed. Need to understand that this is a tough problem.
I would second what Roger is saying, and I would put it in a slightly different way. Have you looked at what Google and Facebook and Twitter do for this kind of situation?
Yes. So, for example,
this is not an uncommon problem to solve, right?
No, it's not. I mean, so first to answer your question about what Google does, right? Now, Google's answer to all these problems has been Spanner. They have this transactional geo-distributed database. And our idea is not, so Spanner essentially talks about these small data tablets with PAXs running on top of them. Our approach is not very dissimilar to that. Say that music has been inspired by Google's approach to Spanner, where they said that the only way to achieve distributed transactionality across multiple things is to have this combination of distributed PAXs groups with data. We are saying something similar. It's just that we are building it in a different way. We would like to think, yeah.
Why not just use what Google does? Google scale is pretty much probably on par with what we're trying to do.
Yes. So number one, Spanner is not open source. That's the first thing is that Spanner was not built as an open source project. And number two, I don't want to get into a very detailed discussion here. We believe that we don't need that level of transactional performance for a lot of, so we believe that we can perform much better than Spanner by providing less stronger semantics. Now Spanner is trying to provide complete transactionality across the world. I as a researcher, I'm not convinced that AT&T solutions need that. So I think we can do better than Spanner by just reducing the kind of guarantees that we give. But, and like I said, the second reason is that it isn't open source. So we weren't able to take that code and work with it. Ideally, we would have liked to have started with that as the code base. But this is very closely inspired by that because Google has scale similar to AT&T. So I completely agree with you. I'll send you more details about music and then we have a paper written on it, and you can see its similarities to Google Spanner.
So, Bharath, music, as you mentioned, it is a kind of its own service. Music is a microservice.
Yes.
And it uses internally Cassandra and ZooKeeper
yes.
Technologies.
Yes.
I mean, how do you, I mean, if music itself is high available, I mean, we need to ensure that music itself doesn't fail, right? I mean, even yes. if it fails, somebody pick it up. Okay.
Yeah, correct. So the advantage with music itself, right, with the music shim layer that is running, it is stateless because it maintains all its state in Cassandra and Zookeeper. So the notion of checking if music is alive. So for example, currently in our production systems, wherever music is running, we simply have a Linux daemon that keeps restarting it. Because it is stateless, it doesn't really, we can simply restart it. And the music protocols are built in a robust enough way that despite failures, the guarantees are still there. So yes, music is highly available.
Okay. And second question is that, you know, I understand with respect to these services, like one fails, other picks it over because you maintain the state in Cassandra within music.
Correct.
So that can be replicated to whichever service is picking over corresponding SQL DB.
Correct.
But what about active-active? You need to have that consistency of the data, right? In those cases also, does music help in those use cases?
Very much so. So for example, this image can be slightly misleading because it makes it look like there is one active and everybody else is passive, right? But in reality, this crown that I have put, you can imagine it to be crowns of different colors, and the music locking service helps in consistency. So for example, let's say the service that you see in Irvine is the active for certain requests, but passive for other requests, right? And similarly, the site in Amsterdam is the active for certain requests. Now, the music locking mechanism ensures that if you want consistency on a key, that you don't want anybody to, you want to see the latest information corresponding to it, you can acquire a music lock to that key. And after that, you can do what you want with it in Cassandra. So you are guaranteed consistency. So music does provide
the... Do you have this music on the roadmap for ODL, or this is internal to ONAP?
You're asking me if we are trying to contribute this to ODL?
I mean, we have for controllers, we have... We are upstreaming to ODL, that's today, yeah? Like SDNC, APC, and the other controller component. So what is your plan, the AT&T plan, or in general for ONAP? Are we going to put these enhancements into our ONAP platform without upstreaming to ODL or some other open source? What's the plan?
So I think
Parviz, hold on. This is Dan. Let me just correct you a little bit. We're not upstreaming... I just want to clarify, we're not upstreaming the SDNC controller to ODL. We're building on top of ODL.
And it's applicable to all modules, not just ODL, but it's this could be used for MSO,
yes.
ANI, or SDNC, or FC, whatever, whichever they want. It's not tied to ODL or not tied to any controller.
Right, but I do want to clarify my statement a little bit in that if we did find it necessary to change something at the base platform level, with an ODL to make this work, that we would absolutely upstream.
Yes.
I see.
We just haven't had to upstream anything yet.
I see. Thanks, Dan.
To answer the question on what's the plan within AT&T and outside. So our plan is, again, to first get it to work with the AT&T components in parallel and hopefully make it as part of a common platform for ONAP. I mean, it's not like everybody has to use it. People who want to use it can use it. And it's not an all or nothing tool. I mean, the three components here can all be used independently. Even if you don't want to use music, you can still use HAL just for failure detection and leader election. That's the first thing. But we are also starting to try and upstream this into Cassandra. Like, let's talk to our partners who can upstream code to Cassandra, Apache Cassandra, and see if we can make it as part of the larger open source community so that, you know, we don't own app or AT&T doesn't need to maintain and enhance this by itself. So that's kind of the answer for that. We're not trying to upstream to ODL right now. It's a more broader plan, trying to upstream it to Cassandra and AT&T. Yeah.
So what's your plan for release 2? Is this something that you'd roll into an existing project, or is this a new project, or is this just something you're incubating and would bring in later?
The goal is to get it into ONAP as soon as possible as part of a platform. If OOM is the place for that, then OOM. So I think that would be the ideal situation where it's part of the larger platform providing resiliency and high availability. And we are working with internal AT&T teams. For example, we are working with SDNC to take their existing ODL solution and reflecting it using music. And then we can start working with other ONAP components as well. But the ideal goal would be that it is part of the common platform. If OOM is, I need to talk to Roger about that, what he feels about that. But if OOM is the place, then that would be
just a reflection on that. This is Stephen. Just a question and a reflection on that. I mean, I could draw the parallel between this and, for example, the common controller SDK. I'm not saying to merge it into that project, but where you, in principle, provide a set of common things that projects could take and use as per their need. So I wouldn't merge it in with. It doesn't feel right to merge it in with other projects unless because the scope doesn't sort of seem to naturally fit. But okay, that could be that will be a later discussion, I guess. My question was going to be looking at this, and I know you haven't been allowed to finish your presentation, and sorry, I had to skip in and skip out a little bit, so maybe this has been answered there. Part of this looks to me a little bit like a sort of a data management layer, a common sort of set of database services that provide this available data replication. And then, of course, the applications that use this, I mean, applications being our own app components, the things you've been talking about that use this, decide how they want to use this and then whether they need something on top of that, because there can be different needs, as Roger was pointing out. Conceptual perspective, do you view this more as a sort of a set of SDKs, or do you view this as sort of a data management layer?
I view this as a set of shared services. In that way, it could be considered a data management layer. But I prefer the term high availability layer because it's more than just data, right? It's about managing control and so on. So I do look at this as a common data management layer. Yeah.
It is about data. Let me kind of agree with Stephen, right?
Yeah. It's not again.
It's not about the apps. It's about the data.
Yeah.
Of data. The applications can be made stateless. They can come and go, they can bounce back up, but it's the data that's important.
Yes.
We don't necessarily have a high availability framework for components in the long run. Maybe in the short run we need to. But in the long run, if we kind of go in a more cloud native way, we could develop a much more stateless model for the applications and rely on a set of data services.
Yep.
To keep the data consistent and the state consistent.
Yes.
I'm also tending to think so. Sort of, essentially, the data microservice, and then if we can also abstract the APIs, for example, let users of the data store express intent, right? For the like the A&A example brought up, then it that's a nice full story. Not just intent-driven APIs, but also a full replication solution, geo-replication.
If we view this as a sort of a data storage service that provides high availability and in different forms, different needs, and different sort of capabilities for the needs of the application, I think that's necessary there. Would the type of database that is actually underneath that be abstracted away, or would that be visible to the applications?
It would be abstracted away. I mean, if the
So that's the part, Steve, if you up-level this, right? So for example, let's put A and AI here, and then what we're saying is rather than just accessing, using A&A assets like today, it's a graph database, and then use it as a graph database, have intent-driven APIs so that the underlying database itself can be replaced, right? And then, it could be made in a NoSQL database, which is high higher performance. And then at the board of it, music provides this, geo-replication multi-site abstractions, right? So it's a whole story around data management, data microservices.
Just a time check on this. Just a sec. We're running a bit long on this presentation. Bharath, can we wrap it up in about another 5 minutes?
Absolutely.
I'll let you take
I have just three more slides, so no problems.
Okay.
Okay, so I think we have had a great discussion so far, and I've already spoken about HAL. This is more a package for failure detection, leader election, and so on, because we don't want everybody writing code that talks to console or Zookeeper, right? We ideally just want them to do some configuration and we'll take care of it for them. And then Conductor, like I said, it's already part of ONAP. This is mainly done for request redirection when a failure happens, like a replica fails, you want to redistribute its requests, you want to choose the appropriate candidate rather than statically fixing that, you can use, we use Conductor internally for that. So the last slide, I just wanted to make a note about the tool code complexity, because sometimes when I presented it, I almost presented like it's a new database, but in reality, Music is two very well-tested production tools, Cassandra that we use to store state and Zookeeper for logs. And we don't modify either Cassandra or Zookeeper. We use it as is with barely 2000 lines of additional code to shim them together. And most of that code is the necessities of a REST API and things like that. It has been tested within AT&T for almost 1.5-2 years here. HAL uses Zookeeper logs. We are not tied to, and again, we are not tied to Zookeeper. We are totally open to having console or etcd, because to me, they perform similar functions to Zookeeper, but do a better job of it. Very less than 1,000 lines of code. Conductor doesn't even matter because it's already getting into trying to be pushed into ONAP. But again, just 1,000 lines of code. So it's not a very complex code base. I mean, I would like to sell it like this. For just around 5,000 lines of code, don't change your database and you get multi-site performance and behavior. That's the main selling point. So I'll send these slides to you guys. So I also wanted to, we also went through some very focused design exercise with tech dev partners for, you know, AppC and MSO and so on. I'll let you guys have a look at this offline, because it's quite detailed. Just going through an end-to-end design pattern as to how CHAP would be used. So that's it. I mean, to just recap, the whole goal is to, you know, get 5 nines of availability with 3 nines of infrastructure. We provide Music, HAL, and Conductor as this package, which is not an all or nothing. I think people who want to use it can choose different aspects of CHAP that could benefit them. So thank you so much for your time. That's it.
Great. Thank you.
Can I ask a question, Chris?
Sure. Go ahead, Jason.
Yeah. So thanks, Bharath. This is really, really good stuff, and excited about, you know, finding a way to leverage something like this in ONAP. I was wondering if, as follow-up material, if you could provide information on what projects would need to, you know, what they would need to change or not change, or what interfaces they would use to adopt this, right? So I think you said the database doesn't change, but does anything have to change on the database calls, or, you know,
correct,
configuration files for HAL? You know, what are those configuration files? You know, are they HAL specific ones? Are they, you know, something around one of the underlying tools? You know, some understanding of what it would take for a team to adopt it, I think would help.
Got it. I think one thing I could do, again, this whole ONAP CHAP design I was talking about does go into considerable detail as to how the component has to behave and how, what needs to be done. That's one thing. And second thing is, we have an end-to-end development that we have done, taking MSO state and using Music and HAL to export that across multiple sites. I could try and tease out some of that and show it to you. Plus, I have some demo videos and stuff. I'll put together a package. And do I upload it somewhere, or do I just send it to you, Jason? How would you?
Why don't you put it on the contributions page on the wiki for the architecture subcommittee? So okay. If you just look for a page called contributions, it should show up. It should be the only one in the search.
Okay. I'll do that. I'll do that within the next couple of days.
Great.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, next we have Srini to talk about console.
Okay. Okay, let me share to my screen. Okay, do you see it?
Yes.
Do you see my session? Okay, great.
Yep.
Okay. So Bharat talked about replication of application data or application state data and etc. But there is also a big piece of it in ONAP and any microservice deployments. There is something the service configuration itself. So that's what we are going to talk. I mean, how that service configuration can be can take advantage of a distributed KV store. So that's the kind of presentation which I'm making today. So some background. If you look at ONAP services, there are some Java-based services and there are some Python-based services. In Java-based services, you have factory default resources called properties, and in Python they are basically put in a file called settings.py. The typical configuration properties, what we found is that there are some DB specific information like password and the IP address RFQD and for various databases. And then access information of other microservices, and then Kafka-related or DMAP-related access information, log destination, and the Vim-specific information like OpenStack-related information, and there are many more. Today, if you look at this, these are all files in each microservice. And then we are talking, today in the ONAP, only one instance of each microservice is being brought up. So it seems okay at this time. But when we go into, auto scale out of ONAP microservices themselves, then there is a need to ensure that these configuration properties are basically consistently made available to all instances of the microservices. If you look at second point is challenges. The configuration parameters, how they are used by microservice applications, there is no uniform method, of usage as well as updating. Okay, and also more often we did not see any dynamic update of configuration parameters possible, even if it is updated. The microservice need to be restarted. So there are some of the challenges which we kind of thought that we would have when we go into auto scale out of microservices. So we had this experience before in other projects. So we used a distributed KV store for storing the configuration information instead of storing it in files. So those are the kind of requirements. Any configuration settings, you need to have uniform representation across all microservices, whether it's in Java or Python. And we also want to ensure that there is no duplicate configuration settings across microservices, because they share lots of configuration, they have lots of configuration which can be shared. So we want to have only one copy of those configuration settings in the whole system. And we also need to have the ability to modify the configuration without restarting microservices. Okay. And again, as I mentioned, when there is an auto scale out of these microservices, they all should have the same understanding of these settings. And then there are some more requirements beyond configuration. As Bharat mentioned, at times when you have these multiple instances of a microservice, some operations may need to be done by only one microservice instance. That means there should be some kind of master and leadership kind of role somebody has to take out of those microservice instances. And sometimes when you have multiple instances, you want to coordinate your operations using distributed semaphores or distributed logs. And also when there's a configuration is changed, it should be automatically notified to the microservice instances so that they can reload the configuration from whatever store it is. So those are the requirements we felt needed for any microservice-based development. So this is a kind of a picture. On the left side, today you have services with the configuration files built into them. And what we really believe is that there are services would be auto scale out in future in ONAP release 1 beyond. And they basically getting the configuration settings from a distributed KV store would be ideal. And also any administrator should be able to look into the KV store and figure out what kind of configuration settings they are, and possibly modify the configuration settings. So the basic idea is that all instances of a service should see the same configuration, and whenever the configuration setting is changed, they should be notified. And those instances can be geographically separated. That should not be an issue. And since we are talking about multi instance of a microservice, there is a need for later election at times. So that should be possible. And then as we talked about, at times you require some coordination among the instances. So that's one of the requirements which we talked about. So the recommendation is that there are two popular distributed KV stores today, Consul and ETCD3. Both are very good candidates. Both support beyond distributed KV stores, they support service registration and discovery, and they support later election, distributed semaphores and logs. They all support REST-based APIs. And they have client libraries for many, many languages. And both Consul and ETCD used by many popular open source projects. Both are actively maintained. But the proposal is to use Consul in this ONAP because we are already using Consul for service registration discovery as part of MSP. Since we are using Java-based microservices, I try to search whether we have support in Java and the Python. So the CFG4J is a very popular configuration tool. It has Consul backend now. So any Java application that is using this library to read configuration files today can continue to work with Consul. But many ONAP projects which I saw, they have their own logic to read the configuration files today. They are not using this kind of library. So that could be one change required in services if they need to go with this distributed KV store. And in case of Python, also there is one package called ENV Consul package that reads configuration settings from Consul and then make it available to Django-based applications. And in future, as part of our security stream, there is a need to use some security secret server as Vault. It uses Consul as native database. So that's the reason we were thinking that Consul would be a good candidate for both for configuration also, in addition to service discovery and registration.
Srini, this is Roger. Just to add to that OOM deploys Consul for health monitoring, and so does DCAE. So it is already used in the system. Not in exactly the same way you're talking about here, but but it is console.
So we're extending the use of console then beyond the health tests for the KV store, and we'll be doing the service discovery this way as well, or are we going to stick with the existing service discovery mechanisms?
Even today, my understanding is that console is being used for service discovery. So I know that, you know, MSP is a kind of a wrapper on top of console, and MSP internally uses console service discovery feature.
Okay.
So the question back to what Dan said, we have the for controllers like AppC, SDNC, and so on. We have the common services SDK, and then we have the application like SDNC and AppC running on top of that. Which one is which? Are you talking about common services or individual component or what?
I mean, that's, I think we should answer your question. Perhaps if not, we can discuss that.
Okay.
Okay. So essentially, the enhancements, assuming that this is accepted, we believe that there are no major changes required in microservices. At least the changes required are typically during the bring up, during the startup of any microservice. The configuration settings, if they use the CFG4J or these kind of popular packages, the console-based configuration comes for free. Otherwise, the microservice teams need to basically use these packages. So some modifications are required to do that. Maybe there may be OVM package changes. Today, OVM, as part of the demo project, expecting users to modify the configuration parameters on per deployment basis. And the OVM has got the ability to push those configuration files into microservices. So that there will be some change. Maybe it may be simpler than what it is today if you use console. And then the third point here is that, even though we are saying that this is meant for settings and configuration for properties, but if there is any critical application configuration also can be saved in console. For example, in Kubernetes, it uses etcd distributed KV store, not only for settings, but also for some runtime application specific data. But it should not be too big, because most of these distributed KV stores, they load all the configuration into memory, and typically they don't expect stuff to be more than one or 2 gigabytes.
Hey, again, I go back to my question. So even when it comes to controller in ODL, I believe that in the latest release, they already integrated the etcd version 3. Now the OOM and Kubernetes on top of that, you're saying that is already, that feature is available, correct?
Let me address some aspect of it, what is there today in R1. The SDNC, today we have multiple microservices. Each microservice, yes, only one instance is being brought up. And all these instances, either themselves or our OVM registering on their behalf to MSP, essentially saying that where this service is present, on which port and which IP address, essentially. So any microservice, whenever it needs to talk to other microservice, refers to MSP to get hold of that FQDN to talk to. But what we are now saying is that in addition to service registry of one instance, if we bring up multiple instances of the same service, all those instances can be registered to the same MSP. So and the console has the ability to provide all the instances of a given service. So that is the kind of facilities are already available in console. Even though they are not being used today, they can be used in R2 and beyond when we have auto scale out. Okay. But what I am really talking about is that in addition to that, since we are using console, since it has a distributed KV store flexibility, it can be leveraged for configuration settings, which are currently there as files. So with respect to STMC, APC, and other ODL, whether they use ODL or not, it is kind of orthogonal to kind of what I'm talking about. It is a kind of a generic functionality across the multiple microservices.
So again, this is Roger. Unfortunately, if things are complicated, I really appreciate you trying to solve the problem of global config. It's not just files, though. We have things stored in environment variables. There's data stored in SQL databases. It's done dynamically in some of the components. They have chef recipes that download and configure it.
Yes.
So I think this is a big challenge for our project, is to try to figure out a good way to manage global config across all of the projects. If this tool helps, I mean, that would be fantastic, I think.
Yeah, that's right. S4, we saw that it be used to update the microservices. In some cases, as I said, Roger, it's being passed as environment variables and internally it is converted into configuration files. Yeah, there are multiple ways people did, so we need to have some uniform method to take care of this. Okay. And this is kind of my last slide. The next steps, assuming that this is something which we all feel important, do some POC, and it is then document learnings and create guideline document, and then let every project follow the same method. So from the process perspective, I don't know. It's really not a new project. It is just a guideline, the best practices kind of thing. So I don't know what is the methodology to take it forward, from the coordination perspective.
So I think the main thing at this point is find a project for whom this solves a problem. And work with them to do a demo, and then probably bring it back to the rest of the community and show how everybody else could use it. I agree with you. It doesn't feel like it's a project in and of itself. It may be some enhancements to some of the other projects, but I think the first thing is to find someone who's interested to do the initial demo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I will post this to our subcommittee and also in the ONAP discuss and see whether there is any project team interested in taking this forward first.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Appreciate the presentation. Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Now we're going to pivot a little bit and talk about microservices. We have several presentations for today. Alex and Ramesh from last week carried over, and then also Ramke. So Alex, do you want to kick this off?
One request, Alex and Chris, I have to actually run off to a meeting, pretty quickly. If you're okay, I would like to go first.
Sure. Why don't we change that around? Ramke, why don't you go up first, and then Alex and Ramesh, you can follow.
Naturally, it makes sense to, unfortunately, to do it the other way, since we're kind of setting the stage in general for a lot of what we need to talk about.
If Ramke has a hard stop, we may have to just go by that order.
Okay.
Alex, that's okay, as long as we can complete both by, around 8:55, 9. So that's all,
Go.
Okay, go ahead then. Go quickly. So Alex, do you have something to share?
Wait, so we... Oh,
Ramke just handed it back to you.
Myself, yeah.
Okay, so Ramesh, do we want to do this? Let's do the shared slide, right?
Yeah, let's do that. And yeah, I'm going to go ahead and I'll chime in. But
okay. Okay. Can everyone see what's going on here?
Yes, we see your slides.
Okay. So this is this presentation is an outcome of having a lot of conversations around how to arrive at some common patterns in terms of how ONAP components need to be put together in order to accommodate a set of different use cases. A lot of companies have looked at it and contributed. They're all listed here. We've also kind of done a lot of conversations with Ramke and Ramesh and myself in terms of how do we kind of congeal all this into something more or less coherent. This is all food for thought. But potentially a lot of this could be brought into release 2 across multiple projects in support of the S3P work. So the motivation is to enable a multi, you know, as we just got done talking, to enable a more federated, more distributed and decentralized set of ONAP deployment scenarios. We've said that, you know, ONAP kind of needs to be multi-site and be able to handle multiple geography, multiple locations. And so the idea is to kind of look at what that actually means in terms of how ONAP components need to be deployed. And then at each site, how do we integrate them into something coherent and manageable, perhaps with OOM. And then there's also a need to be able to extend ONAP with external components, external domain management systems, if you will, that have their own life cycles, their own interfaces and whatnot, and they have specific purposes, but also we want to make that integration as seamless as possible and not be dependent on, you know, all the inner workings of the entire ONAP platform. So specific scenarios that we're kind of looking at would be, and this is, the slide is more focused on domain controllers or domain management systems. But you can also argue that even within ONAP, you know, there's an opportunity to be able to manage things in a more decentralized, more regional way. Right, so we'll have a couple of slides to show that. But the idea is to be able to deal with situations where we have ONAP components that are within the single operator scope, components that are crossing geographical boundaries and perhaps even geopolitical boundaries and have all sorts of regulatory compliance to deal with. And then obviously use cases where there's a need to go across multiple operators to deal with roaming and so on and so forth. So, you know, we could potentially start with a bunch of deployments and different pods. And again, you know, the deployments we're envisioning are likely to be segmented into regions or sites or whatnot. But again, at each site, you have some hardware to manage. You have some service instances that are operating and perhaps spanning multiple locations. And so what we're trying to do is to embrace this notion of management control points that allow us to maintain a single cloud image, if you will, or a single, you know, management plane in a decentralized way across a geographically deployed ONAP environment. And so a management control point contains some amount of ONAP functionality at each site, but may or may not contain everything because you don't necessarily need everything in a regional or federated model to be able to maintain ONAP coherence in terms of how it operates and what it does. you only need to have specific components, perhaps having to do with orchestration functions or data collection or things that are very centric to what kind of application instances are deployed where, okay? And so from that perspective, some terminology that we're introducing, we have a notion of management components, right? And these are software functions responsible for ONAP management tasks. These are the basic sort of units of delivery for ONAP, the management components, right? And then we're introducing a notion of management control points that aggregate together one or more of these components and manage their lifecycle and allow the distribution of management control across complex deployments that may span multiple sites or multiple geographies. And then all of the stuff needs to talk to each other. We obviously need to have some consistent way of connecting things together. And so there's a notion of a management interconnect. You can think of this as the MSB on steroids, but something really a bit more than what it is today. Perhaps something that more like what was presented by Habib a while back. But the idea is that we want to create the illusion or the notion of a single management interconnect that kind of connects all the different sites, all the different management components and control points together, right? And that would facilitate, you know, calling and returning, as well as exchanging data, exchanging control, and so on and so forth. You want to talk about this, Ramesh?
Yeah, so this is kind of, again, you know, there's kind of the specific domain views, and this is one that's kind of emerging in implementation, as well as, I know, Chris, we're working with MEF on this. So MEF has this view of end-to-end service management that interacts with multiple technology domains and their management systems. So I guess we need to kind of think about how ONAP and operates in an environment such as this, where you have kind of these distributed instances, which, you know, may or may not be ONAP built on or using ONAP. They could be, you know, external systems, or they could be specific domain specific ONAP implementations.
Okay, and here's another view.
Yeah, so this one is kind of more the geographic or operating group view. This is a Vodafone slide where you have kind of the group level end-to-end service management. And then you have the different operating groups, Vodafone Germany, Vodafone UK, and so forth underneath, which have their own kind of complete domain management systems. So again, these could be all ONAP based, or could be, you know, other systems that provide ONAP like functionality.
Okay. Right. And so our goal, I guess, is to provide a normative way to implement ONAP functionality. And when we talk about functionality, we're really talking about some very purposeful, very specific functions that we have in the system, as well as maybe general purpose stuff as well. But in particular, we're looking at a way of implementing orchestrators, various kinds of factories that create resources for us in the virtual world or in the cloud world, controllers and managers, data collectors, and advisory functions. We'd like all this to be model-driven, based on the work that's being done in the modeling subcommittee. Ideally, this would be hot pluggable and integration-centric. That would kind of force us to talk about interface consistency across all of these functions and what they really mean. We also want to be able to have a single interface be implemented in lots of different ways so that we can facilitate choice, right? And brokering of what implementation to use based on policies. And then, of course, the whole idea is to kind of get rid of the point-to-point interactions that we have today between between the ONAP components and kind of force a more ordered approach where there's a single point of interaction through the microservices framework or the management interconnect between internal ONAP components, external components that they added to the system, and so on and so forth, or even potentially other opcos as well. And the idea is also to create a level of isolation between how the implementation is done. So by creating that that abstract API that we implement in perhaps in multiple ways as needed, we would attain that. And obviously, we need to be able to manage the lifecycle of the ONAP components and perhaps even external components as well that are added to the system. So we've talked about the slide before, and you know we've shown it a couple of times. The whole point is to kind of jog your memory and talk about different kinds of layers that we've been talking about, and this is just, again, has not been fully agreed on yet, but just as a working model for how we want to organize information and bring it together as a set of layers into a shared state or some sort of an external model that would drive our external APIs. But the interesting thing about this is that we can also look at our components or management components as something that spans or fits into individual layers and therefore deals with the domain specific data models in each layer and is driven by what's there and in essence can be thought of as a set of management component that collectively manage a set of objects in different domain specific data models. Again, this is intentionally vague for the most part because I think if we're going to go to a model driven approach and we are going to go to microservices, simply saying that we have a project and it has six microservices enough may not be enough. We may find that we kind of need to start breaking down the project boundaries and doing something a little more holistic. This is just a crazy way maybe of looking at things, but maybe not so crazy. There's another important concept that I think we need to consider, especially if we're gonna have these notions of regional control, and that is a notion of a software FRU. Think of a FRU as a field replaceable unit. This goes way back to the old days when we had hardware instead of software, but it applies equally in the software world. And the idea is that a FRU is really pluggable, right? It's plug and play. I can add it, I can remove it, it knows how to reobtain its state. And, you know, if we go back to the presentation that was done in the beginning of this session, being able to create stateless components that know how to obtain their initial state when they're plugged in, quote unquote, or go down or get upgraded is pretty important, I think. Again, this would require some sort of integration model as a backing store for the state. And the idea is that this would support in-service maintenance as well as all sorts of other useful things like versioning and being able to support multiple versions of the same API and the same FRUs at the same time. Okay. So now if we have something like this, now if we kind of look at each individual unit in more detail, you know, we can kind of think of each management component implemented in this particular way, right? You have some endpoints, some interfaces, and some are for the administration purposes, and perhaps these are the ones that OOM uses to manage the lifecycle of a management component. And then we've got consumption interfaces that are used by the consumers of this component, right? The difference between the two, of course, is that the administrative endpoints would be normative and follow a specific model. The consumption endpoints might be very different depending on what each management component does. And then logically, from the implementation perspective, you kind of have two parts, right? You have the part that implements the administrative endpoints and the part that implements the consumption endpoints. And these could be co-located within the same application, or these could be, you know, far apart or close together or whatnot. It really doesn't matter from a logical perspective or a conceptual perspective. There's still these two parts. And of course, we have resources being consumed across the board. Was there a question? No? Okay. One other thing I forgot to mention on the previous slide is that by using this this kind of a pattern of a field replaceable unit, we can reuse we can reuse existing software, right? We can adapt them through adapters, or we can combine multiple software components into a single kind of logical component with a single interface. We can also split things apart in a more functional sense as it makes sense, right? So this is pretty important. But whatever we do, this is sort of the underlying anatomy of what a software unit looks like. Okay.
Hey, Alex.
Yes.
Yeah, this is Parviz. This is good. I forgot to ask you when we met the other day. Do you have a plan how to divide and conquer? You have to just create the boundary of some limited number of projects that we do in R1. Do you have a slide on that?
You don't need to reinvent the world to do this, right? You know, so this is something that's done by creating facades, right, in front of existing software first, most of what we do can certainly, you know, be done that way or handled that way. So you don't necessarily have to rewrite the world. You can simply start by doing refactoring of existing interfaces and creating facades. But then in as we kind of progress and change how we do things, you know, perhaps we can adopt a native implementation pattern as well.
So what are the baby steps then? You know, if we wanted to take some of the steps towards this in R2, where do we start?
Well, we could take a few simple services, and we'll talk about that. We have a couple of examples of this that we could potentially use as a starting point. And that's coming up in a couple of slides. Maybe we can wait until then. Is that
perfect?
Okay?
Yeah, just one comment I wanted to add, Alex. I think there's two parts to that question. One is like existing ONAP components and how do you kind of add that facade? And then the other part, which is where kind of I'd originally started from, was to look at how do you integrate external components. And we'd actually started with SD-WAN systems out there. And so that could be another baby step in release 2, is to take a look at one of the existing SD-WAN solutions out there and how do we integrate into ONAP, right? Using this.
In fact, those are the examples. And the other one is from the multi-VIM space, as well as other controllers that we might have that we may want to recast in this way. But let's get there in a hurry. So, okay. So what we're asking, you know, in general, if we look at the implementation pattern, we're kind of saying, look, there's a set of normative or quote-unquote standard interfaces that need to be implemented. The rest of the interfaces could be, you know, component-specific. But the ones that we care about is the lifecycle management interface, the one that interfaces potentially with OOM. I'm not sure if that's the right way to look at it, but that's kind of what Ramesh and I have been thinking. And then the capability catalog that describes, you know, component capabilities, and we're thinking maybe using some of the TMF standards to do this. They already exist. And then also being the ability to invoke different capabilities from a management components, right? Once you've introspected into the catalog, again, something that's already been covered in the TMF space. And then some pub/sub asynchronous notifications to do different things. So at minimum, that is kind of could be it, but it could be also additional things we think about. And then, as I mentioned before, you know, there could be a general set of these interfaces, but it might be implemented in different ways. And so there needs to be potentially a brokering function that knows how to choose the right implementation. And then, you know, as a, just to complete things, you know, all of these management components consumes resources, either other management components as services or other kinds of resources. And there's got to be something here that makes decisions about what resources are needed and how to access them. Okay. So, and again, this is just a starting point, you know, so this certainly is not, you know, this is not a, you know, completely definitive view. And so we kind of end up with four possibilities here. We can have a bunch of native implementations that are implemented in a couple of different ways, either multi, you know, in a multi-provider kind of multi-brokered way or in a native way. And the same would be true for adapted applications. The only difference being is that there's an adaptive layer in between the native interface and the external APIs. Okay, you know, think of them as connectors or adapters. That pattern has been around forever. Now, the other thing you can do with these is logically kind of chain them together and kind of start thinking of dependencies between these different services and these management components and in what order they, you know, they could call each other, right? Again, all the calling happens through, you know, one interconnect. And this is kind of where we need to start thinking about how do we register services, look up services, what's the fastest way to resolve calls between them. But you can imagine that I can start out with something that, for example, is assembling something very, very complicated and then break it down into a set of parallel parts that, you know, kind of go off on their own and continue doing the work and then decompose that down to other implementations and so on and so forth. And in some sense, you know, being able to take complex tasks and kind of break them down into smaller tasks would be useful, I think, across the board, you know, both at fulfillment time or assurance time. And so we've seen this diagram before. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Yeah, it says my internet is unstable, so who knows what's going to happen next. But we've seen this, right? And this is just a general way of organizing ONAP that, you know, would kind of fall out of what we're saying, right? There would be, in essence, some set of external interfaces bound by an external model with a gateway and a broker kind of translating between them and internal API calls that, and this may not be a perfect picture, but the idea is to kind of say, look, we've got a bunch of these management components sitting on the bus or on the interconnect. Some of them are stateless on the left. Some of them are data services that have data associated with them and therefore need to be protected in a greater way. But, you know, they communicate internally through the interconnect and when appropriate, you know, go outside through well-defined models and well-defined gateways to do what they need to do. And from the external perspective, if we look at ONAP as a black box, I think we've had this conversation in one of the working groups. There's a set of kind of northbound service interfaces, and that includes, by the way, the inter-OPCO use cases as well. As well as southbound resource-centric interfaces to kind of consume services as resources or consume, you know, actual physical, you know, virtual cloud resources as well. Okay. I'm not able to see what's on chat, so if there is a question or whatnot, let's talk about it. But so this is an example, right? You know, we could have a factory controller or something that runs in the multi-vim layer and allows us to manufacture different kinds of resources all day. And so from that perspective, the catalog could maintain a list of widgets that a particular factory could make. The inventory would tell us what the capacity is or, you know, what is possible in terms of requests. The request interface would allow us to select one of these widgets. and then the state notifications would then tell us if we're out of parts or we're up or down or whatever the appropriate state is, right? And in essence, each one of these little providers becomes a factory instance that know how to handle different kinds of resources, like PNFs or compute storage and network or YAS or PaaS or I'll function as a service much later, hopefully.
Right? Excuse me, Alex. Just a quick time check. We're getting past the bottom of the hour now. Can you wrap up in about 5 minutes to give Ramke some time?
Right. So this is just an example of how this would fit within ONAP in terms of actual microservices and whatnot. This again kind of puts it in the context of the architectural or the functional view, including the specific data services that we might have here. And then I'll let Ramesh kind of finish this off.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. So just quickly, and then a few minutes left to the question earlier about kind of how do you make this a little bit bite-sized, chewable. So this is a specific example of how this is kind of where at least I started from, was to looking to see how you could integrate an SD-WAN, because there's lots of SD-WAN systems being deployed by pretty much every service provider. How do we integrate that into kind of an ONAP instance? And the next few slides, I will pause this. I'm not sure I'll kind of get through all the details. Essentially, taking the framework that Alex talked about, and how do you integrate this SD-WAN external domain system into ONAP? And the slide basically showing the.
You want me to go forward, or you just tell me when to move?
Yeah. So just one point, and then you can forward it. So. So those who are not familiar with kind of SD-WAN implementations, they tend to be fully functional. They include most of the ONAP functionality, except targeted to a specific domain. So they include some kind of analytics, DCA equivalent, some kind of AppC configuration, an SDNC kind of controller. So the question is kind of how do you take that domain system in and integrate into ONAP with using the framework that Alex talked about earlier. And the next, so you can go to the next slides, is now basically looking at the various fulfillment, kind of the design time, service onboarding, and then the service fulfillment and assurance, and kind of walks through concrete examples. So in this case, Alex talked about how you expose the catalog of, in this case, the SD-WAN DMS into the ONAP service catalog. So what's the interaction between kind of SDNC and its view of services and what, widgets and components that the SD-WAN system is building, and how does that kind of get exposed through a catalog API, and for example, the TMF one that Alex referenced. I want drain the slide in terms of the kind of detailed example here, but you can look at it as we go through the slides. Maybe go to the next one, Alex. So this one is on the service fulfillment side. So again, going back to what Alex was talking about in terms of the requests. So this is kind of requests coming from the ONAP instance to the DMS saying, go and fulfill the SD-WAN portion of the end-to-end service. And a couple of different interactions or interfaces involved here. The service ordering one, which could use like the TMF 641. There's also some interaction with the service inventory, because there is kind of a local service inventory in the DMS, as well as there's an end-to-end service inventory in the ONAP instance, and this is another API and interface. TMF has done some work.
Hi, Ramesh. This is Adrian here. Can I ask a question just around the the APIs, like the TMF APIs that you mentioned there, we're really dependent on those being implemented right by the external framework API project, right, to have a wraparound on in terms of this DMS project, right? It has a reliance with the external APIs framework project, right?
Yeah, that was what I was showing in the first slide.
Yeah.
And that was what in Alex's slide as well. There was kind of this external API broker interface, and that's where you would need to implement this, and then an adapter on the DMS side to adapt the native interfaces into that kind of standard interface.
There's a bit of recursion happening here. We're basically saying that the same thing we exposed externally could be exposed by the components of the entire system and so on and so forth, right? So, but let it be based on the same set of conventions.
Okay.
And then, yeah, maybe Alex, just go to the last slide. Kind of,
one quick question. Alex, the DMS is in scope for ONAP or is partially in scope?
Well, so if we want the, you know, let me answer it this way. If you want ONAP to be successful, it has to be extensible. And it has to be easily extensible with additional value add functionality. Otherwise, it can be monetized easily by integrators and others. And so whether DMS is in scope is the answer is, yeah, it has to be, right? You know, but, you know, it's more from the integration perspective.
Yeah, okay. Let me maybe add another little wrinkle to that, which is, I mean, the DMS itself can be implemented using ONAP components to make it kind of domain specific, or you could have external systems already being deployed, and how do you integrate it into kind of a master ONAP, if you will. So there are multiple scenarios.
It's mostly the latter case, yeah?
Yep.
How much more do you have, Alex, since we have one more presentation?
No, I think we're pretty much done. I think, you know, the appendix, there are some specific industry standard examples. We've seen some of this, which kind of just make it kind of more real as to how this framework approach can be used to address a lot of the stuff we see happening at service providers and in other industry standards.
Just a comment, you know, I think what might help explain it a little bit better maybe just to take a kind of a use case that we did like in ONAP R1 VCP and show how it would be done across multiple domains and what APIs and what components would be used, even with external adaptation needed, just purely multiple instances of ONAP cooperating to deliver across domain. That might be the first problem to solve if you want to do it in a, you know, bit by bit rather than purely looking at the adaptation for external controllers.
Yes, I think we kind of need to look at both internal and external side of things. We kind of mentioned that. But we can do it. I'm going to give control to Ramke. We can certainly do this in an incremental way. I agree. We kind of need to figure out the right level of change to be able to introduce.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. And we can follow up on this with use cases in the coming weeks. Let's turn it over to Ramke now for multi-cloud.
Perfect. Thank you, Chris. All. Hope you can see my screen.
Yes, we can.
Okay, excellent. So this is really a follow-up from the a very good workshop we had at Paris, essentially up-leveling what we are trying to do in R2 and beyond, also putting together more of a high-level software architecture plan, you know, aligning to ONAP S3P principles. That's the goal of this presentation. And regarding contribution, member companies, we have expanded beyond the current list, more specifically, deeper participation from Microsoft and Cloudify. So this is the background material from what you presented in the workshop. All is here. It's available in the ONAP wiki, so I put it all together So feel free to take a look at it. And that said, the agenda, we'll quickly review the multi-cloud reference architecture for R2, then the high-level software architecture, then essentially aligning to key aspects for ONAP S3P, stability and scalability for data management. So what we presented, our multi-cloud reference architecture for R2 and beyond, we made some interesting changes. Though the architecture talked about covered everything, specifically what we felt was we have to bring in the edge devices also into the play. In the sense, for example, a practical example would be just the CPU use case, right? To be managed by a consistent multi-cloud layer. And then the other aspect is, we had Kubernetes, but we specifically called out two type of use cases. One is the container as a service, for example, K8s or Docker Swarm running over VMs. Other is Kubernetes on bare metal, right? And last but not least, from a vision, we explicitly, though we had workload, explicitly clarified that we are covering, starting from IaaS, going to PaaS to SaaS, right? And this is really an adaption from the what you presented at the multi-cloud workshop, just to set the baseline. So the next slide specifically dives into a reference architecture for R2. So after the multi-cloud workshop, we had a very good follow-up discussion right at Paris itself. And the key takeaway there was for R2, let's not bother about SDN. There are several components involved, and the community decision was that it is something we should tackle beyond R2, but for R2, focus on everything else besides SDN. Okay, so with that said, let's move into the multi-cloud high-level software architecture for R2. So walking down from the right side, right, you can see provider registry. Essentially what we are really, this is an existing component right from R1, but what we are really critically bringing to the table is, capability, discovering a standardized more information and data models where, essentially looking at capabilities across the board, across all VIMs and clouds. For example, some of the exclusives are, scheduling based on minimum guarantee, right? And a more common capability would be SRIOV, right? Correct, from EPA side. So what you really want to make sure that all these capabilities are standardized and then exposed through this provider registry, right? So that means then from a capability standpoint, once we get that standardization right, then we are onboarding the VIM or cloud only once, right? And the next is the workload lifecycle management, right? So for R2, again, the focus is on IaaS. But here, what we see is, again, a very critical piece, just like standardizing capabilities, it is also to what we found is there is a key industry gap around standardizing object hierarchies. Specific example, go to OpenStack, you call the name host aggregate, right? Correct. So, but what does it really mean? But then you come to VMware, it's resource pool, and it's Azure, it's something else, cluster, right? So, and though these are all quite closely related, but since there is no lack of standardized definitions, what happens is, when it comes to onboarding a VIM or a cloud, you go through that process over and over again, right? What we are really looking at is standardizing these object hierarchies and also, leveraging commonalities across these objects. For example, all of these, even if you look at memory or, CPUs, then they can be expressed in terms of allocation units, right? You can commonize to that level. But of course, as you know, there are exclusives, across each of these objects, right? And the goal is to standardize these across two key aspects. One is the, capacity, just initial capacity, then, reservation, for example, minimum guarantees. And also last but not least, tying the dynamic utilization aspects around data management, standardize all of these aspects. Right. And we'll walk through some specific examples of what the standardization means across cloud providers. And last but not least is the data management part, right? Which essentially the critical aspect we're bringing to the table is really a PubSub model, where essentially data is not being pulled by other modules. No GET type of APIs, it's always a PubSub push model, right? And what we are really seeing is the work in R1, where we are publishing individual host metrics to looking at more of aggregates, or we call the infrastructure class, right? And that would be made available to other consumers at scale, right? And there again, through DMAP and aligning to the other work that's happening around music and other areas, what we are really seeing is be able to replicate at scale both across latency bound distributed data centers and also cover the truly geo-distributed across WAN, right? But the fundamental tenet is like the push model, not the pull model. And this includes, bulk data, for example, utilization about tenants and all those, but also any events which happen, right? Which could be a significant change report, right? And also the other last piece, we talked about standardizing the capability model and the object hierarchy model and all part of design time and being distributed through SDC. And the last but not least, the critical piece is the interface models, where, for example, today, if you walk into OpenStack, then you create a flavor where, your compute, storage, objects are all combined with the EPA, right? Our goal is to make sure that we establish a standard where across the board, across all providers, that means it's not about just capabilities and objects, but standardize the interfaces through, well-defined models. And now going into the multi-cloud, we talked about all the APIs and interfaces. Now, diving into the multi-cloud, what we are also looking at is really deep diving to the plugins and see how we can establish certain common principles for plugin development, right? Case in point, when you get a workload management request, for example, create VM, what we are doing here is we will create an object instance cache, right? Correct. Around DB, it's a database, cache database, resource reservation, for example, it'll come have some CPU memory storage, right? And what we are really seeing is this is a piece which can be used commonly across different plugin implementations, right? Not something like each plugin when it comes in. Today, if you look at how things happen, at least from what I've seen in OpenStack, like each plugin is completely different. Though it exposes a common interface, it's a completely separate implementation. That means bring in another plugin, then it destabilizes the overall platform. But instead, after all, since you have standardized the Northbound interface, right? So why not have one common plugin framework and also a common database which can be leveraged, database cache which can be leveraged for the plugins. And also critically, if you see there is a subtle color difference between the resource reservation and the utilization database, the reason is, again, the property of how long they're going to live, these objects are going to live. We see the resource reservation objects are more short-lived because you'll create a tenant, after that, this cache entry can be removed. But for example, if you're monitoring a tenant and, you're aggregating statistics for it, then that cache is, much more long-lived because you'll likely be subscribing to the statistics, every few minutes, right? And last but not least...
One comment or question. Ramesh and Alex presented an architecture for SD-WAN where there are multiple domain management systems, one per side maybe. They're all getting registered into some common SO at central location. So in that architecture, and Ramesh also mentioned that DMS itself can be implemented using ONAP components. So keeping that architecture in mind and keeping whatever this multi-cloud project, So is it right thing to assume that these multi-cloud components would be part of the DMS in that architecture, in SD-WAN architecture?
I think it depends, Srini, on what lens you're looking at it. I am looking at DNS more of the SaaS model, correct? Right. That is the biggest value it brings to the table. There is an operational framework you're onboarding, correct? And in that, certainly, as we make progress, though currently in R2 focus, you're focusing on IaaS, but this generic framework can certainly be used, right? Can be leveraged. For example, you'll be probably doing some service translations, and you can use this cache concept for sure.
But it is applicable. It is applicable there also, right? If the DMS is implemented using ONAP components, and this multi-cloud project is equally applicable in DMS.
I saw that end of it, there is an ask into a deep dive. I would say we should do that to get to more specifics. But in general, I think yes. But I would really like to deep dive and then say, hey, yes, we can do whatever is needed, through this generalized method.
Yeah.
Okay. Makes
sense? Ramki, again, nothing we presented has to do with SaaS. What we're really saying is that there's a set of functional elements that need to be deployed somewhere in a coherent way and managed collectively and individually. And that's the framework that we're proposing with Rimesh, both for external and internal parts. From a multi-cloud perspective, being able to kind of split things up into kind of things so things happen more in parallel would be very useful. Right, and we didn't get to go through all the examples. We should follow up on that.
Sure, that's correct, Alex. So what I'm saying is, so I took SaaS as an example. So basically, it's an operational framework, right? Like SD-WAN. So then, how do you bring it on board? So if you walk through the example, then we can start putting things together. That's all I meant. Yeah, totally aligned.
It would be SaaS if it was activated as a service from a third-party provider, but that's not what we're talking about.
But you're still at least bringing an operational framework, right? That's what you had in mind, at least as an initial one for SD-WAN. I think in the interest of time, let's talk about it separately, right? I think we're already, maybe this will take a little over time. Chris, are you okay? Like another 5-10 minutes?
I'm okay if the rest of the people are. Anyone have an issue if we extend a little bit? Okay, go ahead, Ramki.
Okay, thank you, Chris. All. So the last but not least is a critical piece around just the multi-cloud itself, not plugins, not anything. What we're really seeing is we need a standardized logging mechanism, especially around performance measurement and troubleshooting. That's a key piece. That's why this is drawn outside the plugins, right? And also just wanted to point out trying to relate this to factory. I mean, after all, though it's all broken down, in reality, basically, you can relate capability, to a factory microservice construct, right? It's called catalog, correct? And then capacity reservation is inventory, right? In that terminology, right? And workload lifecycle management is a request, right? And it's all following the factory pattern, just to put the pieces together. Okay. And next slide.
Just to mention something really quick, Ramki, the standard sure. model you're talking about is pretty important. And I think if we look at the work being done in Tosca, for example, there is ongoing work to define a set of normative types that would correspond to these kind of abstract resources that one would be able
Correct.
to provision through the multi-cloud layer. And so that's a key thing for us to be able to do, I think.
Correct, exactly. And I've actually captured this here, the summary, that aligning with factory microservice construct right in this slide. So sort of, I wanted this explanation to be more with a picture. So I was like, kind of didn't want to do a readout on the slide. So it's all captured here. So another key part we're seeing, I did make a mention of it when Bharat presented, was consistent intent-driven APIs for accessing data stores or also known as data microservices. So this specifically, this observation came from, you know, looking at ANDI critically. And what we serve is, ANDI is a graph database, right? I mean, to just because the graph database, I guess, was chosen was because you wanted to store graph relationships. But what is also interesting is the graph database is only a way of achieving your intent. Your intent is to actually store graph relationships, and even a NoSQL database can do it, right? So that means then if you up-level yourself and start looking at more of APIs expressing your intent and not specifics on database, then you get the benefit of, you know, replacing the database to something high performance, or, you know, you have the land of choices, right, to you. And this we feel is really another critical piece to not just making ONAP stable, but also ONAP the highest performance platform, you know, aligning to S3P, right? And likewise here, like the ANDI observation, what we are also seeing is even for SDC, we have categorized models, and what we are really seeing is, for example, in SDC, we would really like the capability to provide consistent APIs or models data for data store, because we know for sure, for example, the object hierarchy models are more likely to change than, for example, the capability models. So it's best to not marry databases to specific implementations, but have those intent-driven APIs so that, you know, you can change behind, you have your intent, what it is, and, you know, the user of it also expresses properties around, you know, the longevity of the data and other factors, right, of consideration. And then now, on the back end, you can choose your database of choice. It need not be the particular implementation, right?
Hey, Ramke, I just want to make sure I understand one thing. So in release one, we've used the AI to store all sorts of information about the hardware platforms.
Yep.
Are you saying we're going to change all that in release two? Or we
No. Alex, I'm absolutely not saying that. So all I'm saying is, you know, we will continue storing the inventory, the global inventory. So for example, just going back to the slide, when a tenant gets created, right? So here specifically what we talked about within multi-cloud is a cache, right? To enable creating it, and we are standardizing that cache implementation across different plugins. But yes, the final inventory, right? Yes, the tenant object globally from ONAP's perspective is going to be stored in ANDI. Absolutely, yes. The only thing I'm saying is, in addition, it's important to focus on making the APIs access to ANDI intent driven and not be too graph centric. If you pull up the API, it has got graph edges. That's the part we need to change to make it carrier grade and S3P. That's all.
Ramke, just just a clarification. Could you go back to that picture? Alex, I hope I didn't interrupt you.
No. You're fine. Go.
Okay.
Go.
I have a very fundamental question here. I guess, Ramke, you already mentioned that in your last bulletin, in the last slide you presented. The idea here is the SDC is going to do this model-driven, the tools that are available, to present the recipe, or whatever you call it, to the SO. So the SO can initiate whatever the construct is available as part of the information model to the infrastructure provider, in this case, cloud provider, and that can be essentially through either the VNF manager in the AppC or the VNF manager in the VFC.
Correct.
Is that the key? That is the key, yeah?
Sabit, I think we need to break down into sub-problems. Can I explain this while I walk through an example? I have an example at SO.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Yeah, sure.
Okay. And I think, yeah, in the previous slide, actually, consciously, I merged AppC and VFC since that discussion is happening. I will do so in this slide too, right?
Okay.
So, okay. Again, this really captures whatever I explained, right? what is happening and what is, you know, the transaction is, you know, plugin, for example, the logging is plugin independent, right? Correct. And rest, what is, what should be done inside the plugin, and also the, you know, essentially the longevity of the object, that is also a critical piece to consider, right? And last but not least, one point I wanted to raise, there is also, it's also worth considering state reconciliation following temporary interruptions to the master data store. For example, if A&A goes down temporarily and gets restarted, this is an edge case, which is probably, if it's not handled through HA, then in this case, modules such as, you know, optimization framework, other modules can leverage the cache in the multi-cloud to pull up the information, right? This is something to think about. I think this would be sort of the right discussion to have with the, you know, the music work which Bharat is doing to put the pieces together.
I'm not, I'm really trying to understand this whole kind of cache thing still, right? Because in essence, all we're really doing is saying, okay, the orchestrator will decompose the service recipe into a graph, right? Atomic parts. And then it'll say, yeah, here's a list of requirements, intent of what I need. And then the optimization framework, you know, would potentially get engaged and say, and this is our advice on how you optimize placement. I mean, there's a lot of interaction happening there between those two components and directly with the actual providers of, you know, the actual cloud drivers or whatever your cloud providers, right? I'm not sure this cache, what is this cache
doing? So let me, so that's what, there's a practical example to explain it right here in the slide.
Yeah, you have
wait
an example.
It. It's coming. Okay. So just to make sure on stability, we talked about it, but our real goal is to standardize data model for objects, capabilities, excellent interface and login. Logging. That's the area we're driving towards. In that context, we'll talk about the cache.
Ramki, just for and, the record, we do have a standard model for capabilities, and we do have at least nominally standard model in Tosca for resources. So
here is a challenge, Alex. It's spread out. What you're really looking at is across the board, right? For example, not just, for example, pick up OpenStack. I know in OpenStack, there is quite a bit of work done. So there is OpenStack, there is VMware and Azure, and we see clearly there are gaps to fill, right? So our goal is to make that comprehensive list of capabilities, likewise with object hierarchies. And there, essentially, I had a good chat with the chair of HCNFE. There the thought was, yes, there is a gap in the industry, and even OSM could benefit from this, all this object hierarchy and the capability standardization effort, right? And this is the scope of the data model standardization. One is we talked about objects like DC, tenant, cluster, et cetera. Then, you know, capabilities, affinity, anti-affinity, EPA attributes, and also min guarantee reservation and all those models. And basic lifecycle operations, create VM, delete VM, and for R2, we're excluding networking just for R2, and data collection management, resource reservation, notification, and also dynamic resource utilization for objects. And alignment, we see beyond ONAP. And moving ahead, this is a specific example, I think, Parviz, you're asking, and Alex, you're also waiting for. So here, specifically, right, so today, let's take an OpenStack example. What really happens is, you know, there is a concept called flavor. What really it encompasses your, you know, anything and everything, your compute, storage, right? All those parameters and also EPA parameters, all done in one shot, right? Here, what we are really saying is breaking down that part in subparts. Essentially, everything need not necessarily be EPA centric, because if you take, for example, the control plane VM, then, you know, it need not necessarily be EPA aware, right? So with that in mind, essentially what really happens is, this example depicts how we make a smooth transition, you know, given that we're not going to do networking for R2 from current OpenStack Heat or Azure Stack ARM template, right, in the multi-cloud Southbound plugin, right? So what really happens in the sequence of steps, the first is SO to MC, you create a VM model instance. For example, if you're following Kafka, you know, exemplary VM compute storage model has got, you know, memory, number of compute CPUs, then local storage, right, and image properties. Then you have then the EPA model instance. I'll show in the next slide. And you create this, a new EPA model instance.
What is MC here?
Multi-cloud.
But the SO would never call the MC directly, right? It's not really clear. We seem to be violating a lot of, or shortcutting a lot of layers here.
When it calls to the bus, but doesn't mean that it's still requesting a service through the bus.
No, but I guess by the time we get to the multi-cloud layer, we're formulating a very specific request for a very specific resource, right? But there's matchmaking that needs to be done. We're not asking the MC to do the matchmaking. We're asking the optimization framework to do the matchmaking.
And that returns it back to SO.
The matchmaking, this is after the matchmaking. So finally, the end of it, you are passing some sort of heat template, right? Correct. Right. To create the VMs. That's what you're getting at. I mean, I'm skipping the other step for simplicity.
No. Alex, there are two options. One option is, as Ramki is showing here, SO can directly talk to the VM or multi-cloud entity, or it can go through the APC or VFC, the VNF manager. Those two options are already available. Okay? Those are two options that are available.
Yeah. Who keeps track of pending in...
I think one thing I want to make clear is multi-cloud will be agnostic to the caller, just to be very, very clear. This is depicting one option, right? Correct. And let's deep dive into that option. That on who is the caller on the whole workflow, it's sort of a little bit out of scope for multi-cloud, but we should bring it up in the bigger architecture discussion like Vimal and Parviz are pointing out, right? Makes sense.
Yeah, Ramki, I have a clarification, but I let you finish first because I cannot wait, but I promise that to keep quiet, okay?
So essentially, in this case, what you're doing is so you did these two steps. You created a basic VM model instance and an EPA model instance. Then you are still passing the heat and ARM template with the EPA VM and EPA model instance because the network you have not still transitioned. And in the plugin, what you do is there are two variants of the plugin, one for OpenStack where you retrieve the VM model and EPA model instance data, and OpenStack will map to appropriate flavor, right? And you populate the heat template and call OpenStack to create VM, right? And Azure and Azure Stack, what happens is it's different because, as you know, in Azure, there are only certain fixed templated VMs being offered. It's actually captured right in this reference, right? You can't create any arbitrary VM of your choice. You have to just use what is available. So that means what you do is you normalize to a specific hardware and also you round up and you create that appropriate VM size matching to the Azure template. And then the next is also they simply do not offer, they're not exposed EPA capabilities directly. It's all indirect through intent-based mapping. You do the specific intent-based mapping and you populate the ARM template and you call create the VM. So what is really the key point is, these are the operations which are specifically different, creating flavor or the roundup normalized, right? Specifically different between OpenStack and Azure Stack. But the northbound is still going to look like exactly the same between both. For example, creating VM model instance or creating EPA model instance, right? And that's the part we'll standardize. And also the goal is to make sure when it comes to the plugin, they can all leverage a common database a database cache framework, and thus, you know, minimize the code changes.
Yeah. Are you done? Or?
Yeah, Parviz, go ahead.
Ramki, okay. The key here for ONAP is the SO, or maybe the new SO slash DO, or whatever we call it for Vodafone. That entity, it has to decompose. Alex already said that. It decomposes the service component and then extract the all the attributes and parameters that can map into some resources, the infrastructure resources. But today, you can just define the VNF type. And type one could be without EPA capability, hardware acceleration, and so on and so. Type two could be with that capability. Now, that communication already happens between the SO and the multi-cloud. Is that something you're going beyond that? What you're proposing here? Because that's already can be exposed. Actually, even in release one, I believe that that is exposed. Yeah.
So the key is, so what happens is, so today the way multi-cloud works is you're still passing. So even taking a step back, Parviz, so whatever happens when you go back to specific to OpenStack or Azure, right? Going to OpenStack, yeah. Still, whatever, even if there is any communication, what we really see is the fact that you are dealing with a flavor in OpenStack, which combines both standard compute, storage, and, you know, the sort of attributes with EPA, right? That is what OpenStack is. What we are really trying to do is decompose that into more meaningful operations. Just isolate EPA capabilities from standard compute capability.
I'm sorry, Ramki. This is exactly what we don't want to do, right? The EPA, the EPA capabilities get exposed through a set of policies. There's a set of rules that comes into play that says this capability, for example, is associated with a Vim X,
yeah.
Y. We don't need to do any more than that. There's already a set of policy-driven decisions that are going to be made to reconcile which Vim to go to. And that's going to be based on the information.
So the key is, so here is the problem, right? So then what about Azure and Azure Stack, right? So basically they have their own uniqueness. You can't even, you have to do map to the appropriate VM size, and you don't even have EPA there. You have to do the intent-based mapping.
Don't have EPA, but we let them do what they need to do. The whole point is that...
Okay. So, Alex, hold on a second. Here is exactly where we had this intense discussion with Azure to understand what it really means. What does EPA really mean? They cannot expose anything like NUMA, anything directly. They have some intent-based APIs which will expose, and you can use that to program what you want, right? So that's what it is.
Azure will expose a set of infrastructure as a service offerings that could be mapped through policies to specific EPA capabilities or other kinds of things. For example, other rules that we need to be able to enforce during placement, like affinity and anti-affinity. It's a very different interface from what you do in OpenStack. And in fact, the Azure guy, if I remember, kept saying we need to have a different adapter, we need to have a different provider, a different factory.
Yeah. So this is basically doing that part. This is a different adapter for Azure, right?
Correct. You're not going to be able to do a least common denominator here, right?
But this comes down to
This is not a least common denominator, right? To be very, very clear. So we are, for Azure, we are trying to round up and normalize to the what is available in Azure. We are not trying doing the other way, which simply won't work. Correct. This is really that Azure adapter, right? That's all it is.
We don't expect the EPA capabilities to be interpreted by the multi-cloud layer. We simply expect a Vim instance of choice to go and create the actual resource.
I tend to agree with Alex Ramki. I guess, Alex, I'm with you, unless there is something that we are missing, because infrastructure capabilities, the hardware or software acceleration aspects, that doesn't have to be exposed to the service layer, yeah?
Yes.
No, so it is...
Ramki, we're not going to be asking.
Parviz, can you explain your confusion here?
Yeah, like look at the service decomposition by SO. It's going to take the bigger template and then break it down into the component level. And each component has a type ID. If the type 1 versus type 2. In type 1 has EPA capability, the same VNF, the same CPU, the same memory, the same everything. Type 1 has the EPA capability, type 2 doesn't. So at some point, when the SO communicates with the VIM or whatever interface that you define, at that point, the VIM layer is going to say, oh, okay, there is an indication here that I have to enable EPA or hardware acceleration. Hmm. And then as Alex said, from that point on, the VIM has to go and manage the right, orchestrate the right resources from the infrastructure assets. That's
correct.
Not
so,
to the SO.
This is a set of operations which is part of that to achieve that, you know, standardization, right? Parviz, you can clearly see there is a difference between OpenStack and Azure Stack, right? Different operations need to happen. Correct. And this is a way of achieving it. So basically, all we are saying is a systematic way of achieving it. That's all, right? And then through a common northbound model, that's all there is to it. There's nothing more than that. And if you're not looking at a common northbound model, then you're doing this one-off. So what happens is when it comes to VNF, then you have to onboard for each and every VIM, which is precisely what you're trying to avoid, right? We want to onboard all the VIMs only once and then be able to, use VNFs across them, right? That's the whole intent here. Correct?
But hang on a second. We actually want to be able to onboard sources of capacity one at a time. And we want
we want to standardize the onboarding process, right? We don't want to have one-off onboarding process for each and every VIM.
We're not doing one-off onboarding process. That's the whole point of the microservice talk that we just did.
Right. Correct. But then unless the capabilities and the objects are all standardized, everybody has the same view, then you will always be doing custom onboarding, right? Correct. You'll be forced to do that. Microservices will help. But finally, when it comes to onboarding specific parameters, you will land up doing it over and over again. You'll be looking at OpenStack host aggregate, right? You'll be looking at VMware resource pool. That's exactly what will land up happening.
You're not, right? Because you know all of that doesn't need to be exposed. I don't think we need to expose vestiges like data centers and tenants. Those are VCD concepts maybe, but I'm not sure they need to be exposed in ONAP, right?
So that is the problem, right? So we've been, Alex, you've also been part of the optimization framework discussions. There have been requests around exposing, specifically even around whether CPU pinning is available, all those things, and also the utilization per tenant, per cluster or host aggregate. That's the level of detail which is needed to make the overall global placement decision. Again, at an aggregate level, but still, all these objects need to be exposed. That is the ask from, those projects, right? Correct.
Yes,
and likewise, DCAE, so that when you're looking at analytics, you are looking at, the objects in a standardized way across clouds. That's the ask from DCAE, right? Correct.
Well, not correct. Because what we're really expecting is we're expecting the SO to decompose the service. We're expecting the optimization layer to make placement decisions based on policies, including those related to EPA and affinity and anti-affinity collectively, because they need to have a total view. And then once we have an agreed upon topology of what a service looks like when it's actually mapped to infrastructure resources, the expectation is that the multi-VIM layer will go fetch resources and go allocate them and act as an abstraction layer between different kinds of VIMs and cloud touch, points of control for clouds, right?
Okay.
But
this comes down to the abstraction that we want from the multi-cloud, right? And that includes what we want to store in the inventory, so that the optimization framework.
We already have it. That's the whole point, right? The whole idea.
Correct. To me, I think like several of you have been, Vimal, so many of us have been in this discussion. The key idea here is simple, right? So when you populate the inventory, you have to be infrastructure aware, at least at certain objects or aggregate level. You would land up knowing what a tenant is, right? Correct. Because when you create a VM, you create a tenant, right? Correct. And then, or any other type of inventory, you would need information about a host, correct? Right. And then you populate that in ANDI. And it is critical that population happens in a standardized way, not something which is each VM centric.
Standardized way, because if I'm storing something in the AI that says I have a public cloud, I know that I will never get the actual topology information from them. So all I can say is that I have an on-demand source of compute resources. And if they support EPA, I will know what they support so I can enumerate them. That's all I need. I don't need to have a full topology of a data center for public clouds, because that's impossible to get. If I own resources, that's a different story. But there's a difference how you model resources you own versus resources you get as a service.
Correct. Right. So number one, even across just, when you own resources, even there, that is essentially where we have a gap, right? Just simple across VMware and then, OpenStack, right? Even there is a critical difference just in across resources you own, right? Correct. Right. When it comes to cloud, then of course, yes, I agree. Then there needs to be abstractions, correct? But the first problem is we have different cloud implementation, and even there, it's quite different how these are being consumed today, right? Correct. Right. And so, how the resources are represented, they're fundamentally different. And
but Alex describing is exactly what we discussed and said, yes, we all agreed, which is to say, you do the placement decision before you and you identify your what you need, what is the best place to get the resources, and then you make a call to say, go and get me that.
Okay, so why don't we move on?
So just to be clear, just to close on that, MC, Vimal, MC is not making any smart placement decision. It's still actually trying to implement the placement decision, to be very, very clear.
But let's do it this way. Let's kind of work our way top down and see what we need from that layer, as opposed to telling the world what the layer will provide.
Okay, we're not going to solve this on the call today. We're already about a half hour over, so let's move on and let Ramke finish his presentation.
So I think this is a model of EPA asymmetric pneuma example, right? Correct. Just to close that gap. So basically, we talked about asymmetric pneuma here, right? And then last but not least, it's scalability for data management, correct? So push latest aggregate data through asynchronous methods, right? So this is pointing out two areas. Aggregate data, for example, tenant cluster, right, is key to hierarchical multi-site VNF placement driven by OFTCAE. And data at atomic level does not scale, right? And what we are really saying is next is the asynchronous push model for latest data enabled by DMAP. PubSub active sync or lazy replication is key to scale. We need to have both the models. And don't use poll, always a push model, right? That's it. That's the summary. I guess from what I see, there is some slight confusion on clearly, multi-cloud is not trying to get into any smart surround placement. Absolutely not. It'll absolutely obey the placement decision. I think the only confusion I can see is that precision on what happens in SVO on the APIs, right? What happens, correct? I guess that's where the confusion is, if I understand right.
I think
one quick question, Ramke. You said that the asynchronous, like pops up today, even in release font, that is a bottleneck. And for R2 and beyond, we need to really raise the bar and to bring the low latency. The low latency in a matter of fraction of milliseconds. So the proposal, your proposal with the DMAP today is not going to help you much, okay? Because of the latency.
So there are two aspects, right? One is latency, other also efficient bulk data transport. I think both needs to be worked in conjunction, right? So both of them, right? It's not just about latency. Latency, yes, in certain cases, but also how we efficiently transport bulk data, right? If it's, you know, for consumption by other components.
Yeah, we are, both are there. We plan to bring a contribution to at least improve that. Okay, good. Thanks.
So I think we need to apply a separation of concerns model here. Who's going to do what? Because we seem to be violating the layering of things here quite a bit. And we need to, we keep making decisions in different forms, and then we still go back to the same pictures. And we kind of need to understand the roles of different layers in the architecture and what they do. And to that end, you know, what the multi-clouded layer actually gives us and what we need it to provide to us, right? Not the other way around. We need to maintain top-down control hierarchy here.
No, Alex, I think that's definitely not the intention. I think I can see maybe, certainly to conclude, multi-cloud is not trying to get into smarts on any placement. I think it's more of a confusion around, where that standardization is taking place, if I'm not mistaken, right? That's where the confusion is.
But I think the standardization needs to happen in an end-to-end way, right? And so to me, I don't really care about data centers or tenants or anything like that. What I care about is pools of resources with the right capabilities. That's really all I need to expose to the rest of the world. And then I need to know where the watermark is in the pool. Is it low? Is it high? Is it just where I want it to be? The fact that there's something out there organized in a particular way, I'm not sure that adds any value to the layers above. And if it's not going to add any value, then we should look through it.
You will need some topology if you're also looking at placing things related to latency.
If you're doing that, you're going to need a lot more than that. We're going to need to look at monitoring and a bunch of other things as well. You're right.
So I think the biggest, let me try to answer the biggest confusing point. So today, let's take a concrete example, right? Just around two types of clouds. Let's talk about VMware and then OpenStack, right? Correct, right? And it's all completely private data centers. I'm not bringing any cloud. What we clearly see, right, in this case, we need to onboard these clouds multiple times because how the capabilities and how the objects or model are fundamentally different. You need to do twice onboarding, and any policies for which you're dependent on the cloud, you are doing them over and over again, right?
But
this is really trying to do is, you know, Alex, hold on a second. I'm not even getting Azure, right? By standardizing the objects or standardizing the capabilities across the board, we are trying to address that problem. That's all. It's very, very simple, as simple as that. So I'll take a specific VMware example. For example, VMware offers min guarantee scheduling, right? But that capability is not exposed in a, because it's not exposed in a standardized way, then it becomes a cloud-specific feature, right? Correct. What does host aggregate mean in OpenStack, right?
So
those are the things. That,
hypervisor.
And
hypervisor specific feature.
Hypervisor specific. Yeah. I'm focusing on a private cloud, completely operator managed, and where you have a set of capabilities and objects which you want to really standardize. Right, basically put out the max set in front of everybody, right? The maximum possible, right? So that when you make a choice, you know exactly where you're headed, and you're doing this onboarding process only once, and you know, hey, this cloud, this is a set of capabilities it can support, and this is how the object, you're standardizing the object hierarchy, this is how the relationship is going to look like, so that when I write policies, I can write them only once. I don't need to write policies twice, right? I don't need to write OF policies twice,
correct. That's what it comes down to.
We wouldn't be writing them twice because we would be writing them, it's a set of mapping policies, and they will be different depending on what the actual target for the resources.
Correct, but then now it's not going to be what is happening is now fundamentally then you have to understand what an OpenStack aggregate is and you're doing that mapping. Here, because that mapping is done, you are simplifying that process a lot, right? That's the fundamental difference here.
Not really. All I need to know is that I have a pool of resources called X. And the fact that that pool of resources draws capacity from an aggregate in OpenStack should be completely abstracted.
Okay, so Alex, here is what the critical difference is. The pool of resources is a start. It's one common model. But then you have to remember when you go to a host or when you go to a VM, there are specific exclusives, right? So basically, there is a base class you can call a pool. Then there are certain many derived classes. That's what completes the story. You cannot say it's always just a pool. Pool is a base class, agreed. Then you have to build your, you have to derive classes based on it. And that is how the hierarchy is built.
Ramki, you remember I mentioned the VNF type? The VM is a method of implementing your VNF requirement. So VM is just an example. But VNF itself should have that information. I guess Alex's point, which I agree, is you don't have to expose those capabilities below a certain level, whether that SO or VIM. Why you care about exposing your EPA
So assuming there is a VNF type, right? Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the VNF type is basically mapping to some sort of data plane or control plane or whatever it is. Correct. Right.
You define those enhanced, optimized set of resources you need.
And then what you're saying is that all this EPA, etc. So basically, let's go to the specific example right here. I'll just walk you through.
Just a time check. We're running pretty late. Can you wrap up in a few minutes?
Sure, definitely. Sure. I'll just wrap up with this discussion and I'm closed.
Perfect.
Chris, thanks for that. So, Parviz, just to an example. So, in this case, instead of breaking down like that, so there are two VNF types, control plane and data plane, yeah. Right? So, the control plane VNF does not care about EPA, right? That is one type, right? And the data plane VNF cares about it. So, basically, you have two types which you can pass to multi-cloud, correct? And then multi-cloud will translate, you know, as appropriate, to OpenStack, right? Correct.
No.
So because it needs to, and then also to Azure and Azure Stack, correct?
No,
so basically, it needs to pick the.
This is the part we keep just getting disconnected on. We're not going to pass all that to the multi-cloud layer. Multi-cloud layer will get specific resources. There's another layer in between you're missing, and that's what I call the separation of connections. What multi-cloud
Why should that be a separate layer? That's what I don't get, Alex. So why should that be a separate layer?
Framework, Ramki.
It's
called OF.
Okay, let's take that offline. We can go deeper.
Okay, yep.
To be continued.
To be continued. Okay. I'll set up some meeting with Parviz, like a few of us, next week. Let's discuss.
Okay. Perfect.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks.
Great.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, everyone. A good call. I think this was a good discussion today. I will post the recording and links to the materials online as soon as it does the post-processing, so probably around the end of the day. And we'll talk next time. We didn't get to the update from the Tiger team, but we'll cover that on the next week's agenda.
And also, I think, Alex, we'll have a final conclusion on this for sure. So, you know, we can hear an update.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Chris, the action items on my Tiger team report, please pay attention, folks.
Yep. Great. Thank you so much. We'll talk next week. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.